America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from coast to coast, streaming around the planet at airamerica.com. By the way, you can drop by and participate in our blog over at airamerica.com. Click on Tom Hartman. It'll get you right to it. A lot going on in the world today, including the pumping up of and preparation for, in my opinion, a war with Iran. And in the second hour of our program today, I'll be telling you, while the Bush administration and Joe Lieberman, with his resolution that was passed last Wednesday by the Senate, oddly enough, 97-0, and I got the sense from Jim Webb over the weekend that a lot of people had no idea what it was or how Lieberman was going to promote it on his website. But again, we'll get into that in the second hour. I will share with you who the real foreign fighters are in Iraq, because the statistics are out there. I mean, published by the U.S. Army, they're out there. Who the real foreign fighters are. Is it Iran? We'll find out. Right now, Dan Gilbert is with us. He is the guy who has beaten Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee, Tommy Thompson, Sam Brownback, and Duncan Hunter in the New Hampshire straw poll. The only guys ahead of you, Dan Gilbert, are Ron Paul and Rudy Giuliani. Welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Tom.
Dan is running for Republican. His website for the Republican presidential nomination. His website is WeThePeople4FORPresident.com.
That's right.
And yeah, and Dan, I've gone through your platform. And while you talk a lot about what you really want to do is support families, you're all about helping families in the United States. This is all about families. It seems like a lot of your platform is very family destructive. And there's a huge disconnect here. You want to privatize Social Security. You don't think that the government should play a role in equalizing incomes in the United States. And yet the time in the United States, the 1960s and 70s, when we had the highest marginal tax rate in the 90% range in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the highest marginal tax rates in the United States and the largest government interference was the time that we had the greatest social mobility and the family was the strongest in the United States. Why are you so resistant to going back to that?
Well, I would love to go back to that, but I'm not sure it's what...
Well, it's going to take a 90% tax rate.
What we have to do is give families the opportunity to do things for themselves, not depend on the government to bail them out of situations they get into because of addictive behavior or because of the situation they're in. They don't need entitlements. They need opportunity, and that's where.
So you think if somebody has an illness, that they should just deal with that on their own. The government shouldn't be involved in that.
The government should put into place situations that family will have opportunities to better themselves.
So, for example?
For example, being able to take a second job and not be taxed on the Social Security for it.
So your answer to everything is tax cuts.
Tax cuts work. To a certain point, you still have to have money for the defense and Social Security and things that the government is responsible for.
Then how do you deal with the reality? And it's a fundamental reality, Dan, that in the 70s and 80s, 60s and 70s and 80s, working people were taking home a whole lot more money than they are right now. The ability of a family with one person working to put their kids through school, to have full health care, to have vacations every year, to have a pension and a decent retirement, all of that was intact. And all of that has been taken apart since the Reagan Revolution as part of you guys, the conservative program to dismantle what you guys call big government. And what we have now is we're back to the Gilded Age. We have this huge, massive inequality, incredible explosions of wealth, incredible explosions of poverty, and the destruction of the American middle class. Why do you want to do more of what's destroying families in the United States?
I don't believe it's what you're saying. I do think that there is a political agenda up in Washington, D.C., that is promoted because of these incumbents getting back in office year after year and wanting to do things for big business and special interests that take away from the little guy. Now, what I'm about, I don't know if you went on the page that talks about We the People movement, but what I'm about is encouraging and inspiring other businessmen and women, professional men and women, to run for political office held by the career politicians up there now. If we, right now, the approval rate is like 14%.
Are you suggesting that the solution to America's problems is to be found in turning to the business people? I mean, this is, you know, Sanford Weill, I was quoted in the New York Times over the weekend, is essentially saying the same thing. You know, he's this generation's Andrew Carnegie, I guess, or thinks he is. And, you know, another one of the robber barons, the former chairman of Citicorp, with his $1 billion. And essentially saying, yeah, you know, well, this is what Carnegie said. I don't want to quote Weill because I don't have it. But, you know, Carnegie's point was that he's a rich philanthropist. He'll decide where the money should go. The government shouldn't decide where the money goes. Is that the kind of world you want?
Yeah, the government shouldn't get the money in the first place. The less money.
But isn't the government us?
The better off the people on the street are.
But the people on the street, if you look at reality, Dan, and we're talking with Dan Gelbert, who's running for president on the Republican ticket. He's the number three candidate in New Hampshire right now in the straw poll. And his website is wethepeopleforpresident.com. Dan, if you look at reality, what you see is, I mean, you know, look at the history of the United States from 1900 to today. Just look at year by year. What you find is that time during the Eisenhower administration, during the Kennedy administration, during the Nixon administration, during the Johnson administration, right up till Reagan came in and started changing the rules of the game, when we had 70 to 90% as a top marginal tax rate, corporations were paying their share of the taxes in the United States. They were paying 30, 35, 40% of the total tax load. They're now paying about 5 to 7% depending on the state you live in. Back in the good old days when the rich really paid their share for what they got out of this society, we had the highest levels of safety among families. Families were very stable in the United States. And I just don't get it, why you guys want to pull all these things out from all these rugs out from underneath people. You want to privatize Social Security. You don't think that the government should be involved in health care. You're on your own, buddy. You don't think that there should be any welfare programs for people who've had disaster strike them. I don't get it. It doesn't seem even Christian to me, much less, you know, practical.
There has to be a safe net for people that fall through the cracks. There's no doubt about that. And all Republicans that I know and all conservatives think the same way. And what happened back in the 1960s and 1970s is the values of this country went south, and people started having babies out of wedlock. They didn't get married. They just moved in. So there wasn't two household incomes, and so what happened?
What people had dropped,
and they.
We've always had that problem, Dan. I mean, you know, that's been part of American history. The fact of the matter is, if you look at infant mortality and you know, a lot of children in poverty, any of the indexes of disasters among families, you find that those levels are higher when the conservatives are running economics, like in the 1920s and the early right up to the Republican Great Depression. And since 1980, those numbers have been going north, not south. And it was liberal policies like put forward by Dwight Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. It was those liberal policies of, you know, let's be there and, you know, we the people are here for we the people, that protected families.
We need to protect the opportunities that the family has, not
what, the opportunity to become a billionaire, you mean?
No, I'm not talking about billionaires, but give people on the street the opportunity, the entrepreneurship ability to go out and start a company like I did.
How can somebody become an entrepreneur if they don't have health care? If I give up, if the average worker gives up their job, they're going to lose their health care, and if anything happens to them, they're screwed. How can they go out and become an entrepreneur if they don't even have the guarantee of health care?
They have to take a risk, just like I did back in 1987.
So you're on your own, Charlie.
Yes, you're on your own.
Well, see, back in the 70s and 80s, when you and I were starting businesses, Dan, healthcare didn't cost that much, number one. And number two, as I recall, the laws were that at least in Michigan, I know in the 70s when I was in Georgia in the 80s, a couple of businesses that I started, that the healthcare insurance companies couldn't bar you from coverage for pre-existing conditions. That's all changed.
Well,
Dan?
I'm not that familiar with the healthcare system. I do know that there are like three factors that are causing healthcare costs to go up. One is the legal expense.
So it's all about the John Edwards lawyers. Dan, people can read more about it. WeThePeoplePresident.com. Dan Gilbert. Hey, Dan, thanks for being here with us.
Okay, thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Attention Air America listeners. The complete MP3 archive of almost every Air America show ever broadcast is now open and free to everyone. But it only contains shows that are no longer available from Premium. To get the most recent shows, you will still need to subscribe to Premium. For details, visit airamericaplace.com/archive.
I think we missed it. Anybody here see the love, see the hate, the emotion?
21 minutes past the hour. By the way, we have a comment line now, 503-323-6620. If you want to leave an audio message, please limit your comment to more than 30 seconds. And remember, we may use your voice and opinion on the air. The Tom Hartman Program comment line. Call in and voice your opinion, 503-323-6620. 620. Well, it's I just increasingly don't get the Republican worldview. I mean, the more I dig into it, the more I just don't get it. In today's paper, the Associated Press. In America, we stand tall. Well, maybe not that tall. Economists are wondering why height in the U.S. has plateaued while Europeans continue growing. And, you know, they lay this out in the 1890s, the average American was a little over 5'8". And today, the average American is a little over 5'10", 5'10½", more or less. Well, back in the 1800s in Denmark, the average Dane was, while the average American was over 5'8", the average Dane was less than 5'6". 5'5 was the average height in Denmark, 5'5 was the average height in the Netherlands. And same in Czechoslovakia. Italy was even worse. 5'4 was how tall the average Italian was, and the average Spaniard, 5'4". Now, why is this important? Well, it's important because height is very often an index of general health, particularly young general health. By the age of 2, there's a 70% correlation between a child's height at the age of 2 and the eventual adult height. There's also a correlation with life expectancy. Life expectancy in the Netherlands now is 79 years, over 79 years. In Sweden, it's over 80 years. In the United States, it's only 78 years. While the average citizen in the U.S. now is a little under 5'11", the average citizen of Denmark is over 6 foot, Netherlands over 6'1". And, you know, you just go right down the list. It's by the time baby boomers reached adulthood in the 1960s, most northern and western European countries had caught up with and surpassed the United States. Now, why? I would suggest that the why is because they have national health care. They have good programs. They didn't have government policies being driven by corporations saying, let's sell more junk food. They go on to note, even residents of the formerly communist East Germany are now taller than Americans. And again, this isn't just tall is good or short is bad. Obviously, you know, there's a million things that affect that. Genes are a big one, but genes are only 40% of the variable. Environment is a much more significant variable here. And so what we're seeing is Americans slipping. And I would suggest that the big issue here, the one that nobody is willing to talk about, and this just blows my mind, that nobody is willing to talk about, is taxes. In the New York Times this weekend, Louis Uchitel was writing about Sanford Weill, the chairman of Citicorp. One of the new titans. The new titans see themselves as pillars of a similarly prosperous and expansive age. This is the Gilded Age before World War One. One in which their successes and their philanthropy have made government less important than it once was. Mr. Wilde said, people can look at the last 25 years and say this is an incredibly unique period of time. Well, yes, it is. Reagan changed our tax policies so guys like Mr. Wilde could become billionaires. He says, we didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built, and we shouldn't rely on somebody else to provide all the services our society needs. Nonsense. Respectfully, Mr. Wilde, and every other billionaire in this country, it's simply not true that you made all your money all by yourself. Any more than it's true that I made all my money all by myself, or any of us did. Government made it possible. You had an educated workforce. You were using the infrastructure of government. You were using the court systems of government. You were using the monetary system that we provided in place. And your raw ingredient, particularly at Citicorp, was labor. American labor, and in the last decade or so, foreign labor. Progressively cheaper and cheaper labor. You call Citicorp, if you've got a credit card with it. Oh, and let's talk about credit card policies. And what do you get? You get a human being who probably doesn't have a pension. Well, I can guarantee you doesn't have a pension. Well, let's say probably. I don't know for sure. Who probably doesn't have comprehensive health care insurance and who may be working as a temp or a part-time worker. This is what, in by and large, the exploitation of labor in the United States and a change in the tax policy is what has allowed this new Gilded Age to happen, and it's wiping out the American middle class. In 1951, the year that I was born, the average in America, if you made in today's dollars, what was then $4,000, in today's dollars, $32,300. That was the beginning of the bottom end of the tax bracket, which was at 20%. Paid 20% income tax. Plus, you know, that's a $4,000 income. You had deductions that equaled almost $3,000 in your single person, married couples, and dependents. You had a family of four, basically, you paid no income tax at all. With that $32,000 a year income in today's dollars. But if you made over $3.23 million in today's dollars, what was $400,000 in 1951? If you made over $3.23 million, you paid a 91% tax rate on everything over the third $1 million. The first $3 million, you're paying a lower tax rate. Everything over $3.2 million, you start paying 91% taxes. And what was the result? We didn't have tycoons. Dynasties did not emerge. And the middle class flourished. And I tell you, no Democrat is willing to talk about this, but this is the truth. This is the bottom line. We need to return to progressive taxation. 27 minutes.
Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And a call out to Brian, the guy in Seattle. Louise and I were up in Seattle this weekend for this talk radio gig. It was just great fun at the Air America station there, Talk 1090 in Seattle. And Brian walking around the city with a sign that says, listen to Air America AM Talk 1090. Also, by the way, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio, supported by our sponsors. There was a sponsor that I met at the Seattle event, a restaurant in Seattle. And I wish I had my – I'm going to have to bring those notes back in for tomorrow and share it on the air. The name of the restaurant, he said that the advertising on Talk 1090 was bringing in 3, 4, 5 tables a night into his restaurant. The success stories we were hearing from advertisers, just absolutely great. So thanks for supporting our advertisers all across the United States. In contrast to many of his peers in corporate America, now we just – you know, Sanford Weill weighing in, the billionaire from Citicorp, saying, yep. He says, we didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built, and we shouldn't rely on somebody else to provide all the services our society needs. Yeah. Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Fed. Remember Paul Volcker? He says, come on. He says, the market did not go up because businessmen got so much smarter. adding that the 1950s and 1960s, which the new tycoon denigrates as bureaucratic and uninspiring, quote, were very good economic times and no one was making what they are now. Robert Crandall, the CEO of American Airlines. I used to do consulting work for American Airlines back years ago, advertising marketing training, actually, for American Airlines years ago. And I remember Bob Crandall. He was, you know, he ran the airline. He never made more than $5 million a year. He retired in 1997. This from this New York Times piece by Louis Ushatel this weekend. Louis writes, the nation's corporate chiefs would be living far less affluent lives, Mr. Crandall said, if fate had put them in, say, Uzbekistan instead of the United States, quote, where they are the beneficiaries of a market system that rewards a few people in extraordinary ways and leaves others behind. The way our society equalizes incomes, he argued, is through higher taxes than we have today. There is no other way. End of quote from the former chairman of American Airlines. They note in the article, individual fortunes nearly a century ago were so large that just 30 tycoons, Rockefeller was by far the wealthiest, had accumulated net worth equal to 5% of the national income. Today it's about 19,000 tycoons in the United States who have 5% of our total net income. But the effect is about the same. Mr. Senegal, the co-founder of Costco, the chief executive of Costco, he says, again, from the article, in contrast to many of his peers in corporate America, Mr. Senegal, 70, the Costco chief executive, argues that the nation's business leaders would exercise their unique skills just as vigorously for $10 million instead of $200 million if that were the standard. Now, this is a guy he's not doing bad. He owns $150 million in company stock. He's certainly wealthy. But his salary last year was $349,000. Why are these guys making $100 million, $200 million, $500 million, $1 billion a year? He says, because everyone else is getting it. It's as simple as that. If somehow a proclamation were made that CEOs could make only a maximum of $300,000 a year, you would not have a shortage of very qualified men and women seeking these jobs. And he's right. Because we had CEOs in the United States in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the early 80s, who were making the equivalent in today's dollars of $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, and that was pretty much the ceiling. And they were doing just as well as CEOs are today, and they were building companies that were just as successful. The difference? 91% top marginal tax rate. I mean, it was pretty straightforward. It's just amazing to me why that. Nobody, even on the Democratic side, even Dennis Kucinich, I can't speak for Dennis. Maybe he is talking about this. But to the best of my knowledge, nobody on the Democratic side is talking about this issue. It's not just roll back the Bush tax cuts. Because he just cut, Reagan cut tax rates down into the 20s. Clinton took it back up to the low 30s. Bush cut it back down into the high 20s again. Clinton took it back up to the mid 30s, the mid to high 30s. Bush took it back down to the low 30s. What happened to where taxes were under Republican Eisenhower, under Republican Nixon? In the 70 to 90% range, at the top range. Now, that doesn't mean that you pay 70 to 90% on the first $50,000 or even $100,000 in income. It means after you make as I said, 1951, after you made $3.23 million in today's dollars, then on income after that, you start paying 91% tax. And guess what the consequence was? A society that worked for everybody. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Kathleen in Seattle. Hey, Kathleen.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good. Your first guest, Dan, I didn't catch his last thing.
Yeah.
Whomever, whatever. It's absolutely frightening to me that he won the straw poll in New Hampshire. I mean, not only is he espousing, does his platform espouse these things that don't work, but his comments about, like, when things started going downhill in the 60s because people were having, you know, babies out of wedlock, and then anyone can do it. I mean, anyone can run for office if you have money. I mean, not only that, but you gave him such a great opportunity to discuss his platform, and he couldn't even articulate it.
Well, this is the problem. What Dan was saying is what all of the Republicans are saying. And these guys, I think, actually believe this stuff. They're still drinking the Kool-Aid that was being peddled by William F. Buckley back in the 60s to young Americans for freedom. And we tried it. We tried it. I mean, Reagan came in and he said, okay, we're going to do this. And we've done it for 27 years now. And it has destroyed America.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that surprised me, too, is that he was still touting the evangelical line about, you know, families and basically promoting a very non-progressive point of view. And even mainstream Republicans are starting to back away from that and from the evangelicals. And that, to me, it just didn't make sense. And the fact that New Hampshire, that he won the straw poll, I'm just thinking, what is going on?
He was number three behind Mitt Romney and Ron Paul. And Ron Paul was number one, actually, in the New Hampshire straw poll. And Ron Paul is even more extremist. Ron Paul says, don't just do away with Medicare. Don't just do away with Medicaid. Don't just do away with public education. Do away with Social Security as well. You know, you're totally on your own. That's Ron Paul's mantra. The guy's a libertarian. Kathleen, great point. Thank you very much for making it. Daryl in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Nothing much. I just love to listen to you. Have you taught college or something like that, economics or something? Because
no.
Can I just be honest with you? Because I've taught it. You are the most, because economics is basically, they define it as the dismal science. You make economic theory and business theory so entertaining and informative. People can understand it.
Well, thank you, Daryl.
I mean that honestly.
I see that as my mission because, frankly, I see economics at the bottom of everything that's going on here. Whether it's, I mean, you know, even the role of women in society is at the bottom line. It's economic oppression of women. That's the main instrument of oppression. Economic oppression of minorities. That's historically been the main instrument of oppression. I mean, it shows up in a whole lot of different ways, but the bottom line is economics. And it's so important that we all help Americans figure this stuff out.
Okay, well, I won't take a lot of time. I'm just going to say this whole notion of the Republican Party, they say the same mantra. The zenith of these ill-gotten policies is Iraq. Everything they've tried or tried to throw down our throat, they've done in Iraq. You know, privatize this, no Social Security, none of this. Everything they've done is a dismal, utter failure, and you can point to Iraq. Anything they tell you now about taxes, you know, let the government – let the corporate handle it. All of that stuff they've tried in Iraq, my friend, and it has been a dismal failure.
You are so spot on, Daryl. You know, Naomi Klein laid that out in an article for The Nation called, I think it was called Iraq Day One or something like that, or Year One or Year Zero. And she pointed out that the neocons had, for a long, long time, they've been saying, well, America's been going down the tubes for 27 years because Reagan wasn't able to fully implement all of our conservative policies. So we need a country where we can, you know, a petri dish, where we can demonstrate this, where we can modify the DNA of the country. We can completely flip the thing and we can show everybody what a paradise it's going to be. And the reason that these guys thought that they didn't need any post-war reconstruction or anything for Iraq was because they said, if we go in and we do away with progressive taxation, and there was progressive taxation. Rich people paid very high taxes under Saddam, and poor people paid almost no taxes at all. In fact, poor people got pensions, Social Security, they had unions. I mean, there's a whole variety of free health care in Iraq. They said, we're going to do away with all of that, and we're going to turn Iraq into a conservative paradise.
Yes.
Flat tax of 15%. Do away with Social Security. Crank down public education. You have to pay to go to college now instead of before it was free. They're going to change all, and they did. They actually, Paul Bremer went in and he changed the Constitution. He changed all those things, and they thought that that would magically cause Iraq to blossom into a paradise of prosperity.
Yep.
How tragic. How tragic.
Tragedy.
It's just incredible. Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. This is incredible. And then on top of this now, the Bush White House said over the weekend, the White House says that this proposal put forward by Congress to expand the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, to cover 4.1 million uninsured children. We're not talking a lot of money here. And by the way, it's coming from tobacco. They're going to raise the tax on a pack of cigarettes from 39 cents to a buck. Nationwide. This is going to ensure 4.1 million children. There are Republicans, enough Republicans supporting this, as well as Democrats, that it will easily pass both the House and the Senate. Bush says he's going to veto it. Because these guys, they just don't get it. They just absolutely believe this bizarre ideology. Coming up in the second hour, by the way, how do we stop the permanent war machine from driving us into another war in the Middle East, like, for example, Iran? Back to your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Attention Air America listeners. The complete MP3 archive of almost every Air America show ever broadcast is now open and free to everyone. But it only contains shows that are no longer available from Premium. To get the most recent shows, you will still need to subscribe to Premium. For details, visit airamericaplace.com/archive.
And if you want to come in from the cold or from the heat, and you happen to be in Grand Rapids on Friday, drop by the Celebration Cinema North. I'll be doing the show live from the Celebration Cinema North for our affiliate WTKG, Clear Channel in Grand Rapids, and also a book signing Friday. This is July the 20th, this Friday, at Schuller's Bookstore in Grand Rapids that night at 7 o'clock. You can find out all about it at WTKG.com. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Kevin in Long Island, New York. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Not much. That guy, Dan Gilbert, he's not really running for president, right? That's some sort of...
No, that was not a pastiche. The guy really is number three in the New Hampshire straw poll.
God, I was shocked. I mean, one, you really, you certainly put him in his place, but...
It wasn't that. I think that, you know... Had he said the exact same things on, you know,
on
Sean Hannity's talk show, it would have been just fine. You know,
you actually deal in reality, unlike a lot of the other conservative hosts. But how is every American supposed to become an entrepreneur? I mean,
right.
Where are the, you know, everyone's supposed to start a business. Who are the employees going to be?
Right. And the thing that people forget is that to become an entrepreneur means to take a huge risk. And before the bankruptcy law was changed so that if you become an entrepreneur and you fail and you can declare bankruptcy, and before the health insurance laws were changed, and they have been changed, and before this huge medical inflation happened, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on, right? It actually was possible to be an entrepreneur, but I would submit to you that one of the reasons, probably not the main reason, but one of the reasons why if you walk into a shopping mall anywhere in America today, you will not see any local businesses. Whereas if you walked into a shopping mall or a strip mall back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or even the early 80s, you saw 90% local businesses is because people cannot afford. And by afford, I don't mean money out of their pocket. I mean the danger of bankruptcy or of medical disaster. People can't afford to become entrepreneurs anymore.
I mean, what sort of business are you supposed to start? You can't start a hardware shop because you can't compete with, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's.
Yeah, no, it's spot on. I mean, it is a potential disaster to become an entrepreneur, and that's a real tragedy because entrepreneurs are what built America, and they continue to be, by the way. The small business sector of America continues to be the major engine of job creation in the United States, and by far and large, the largest engine of job creation that pays well in the United States. Kevin, thanks for the call. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Hey, Tom. I want to tell you what Florida's like. It's not just Iraq. You should come to Florida. We've lived here for over 23 years. We've seen the conservative and corrupt Democratic policies be implemented and take root. And I was just thinking to my wife yesterday, we're small entrepreneurs. We don't have health insurance. I can't get it because, you know, I have a pre-existing condition. I got shafted by Aetna, but that's another story. But the fact is, you should see Florida. What you have in Florida is you have a real thin class of super, super, super wealthy that for all practical purposes consume most of the wealth and control it. Then you've got a veneer of what little middle class, as a whole is the public workers in the public sector, the public jobs, they all provide.
Right. The few that they haven't been able to dismantle. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's the few that they haven't been able to dismantle.
Let me finish. And then below that tier, you have the vast majority. I'm telling you, Tom, there are so many people down here on food stamps, Medicaid, welfare. It's unbelievable. Go to the shopping malls down here, and it looks like third world malls, except for the minority in malls that, you know, are the real high up echelon malls. But
yeah.
And then you have the working class down here that's not working for the government or not wealthy, and they're enslaved. Small businesses.
Now, you're absolutely right, Armin, and you brilliantly make my point. And I know that the story of your life really is the arc of it, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us. Phil in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, hi. I listened to conservative talk radio, Neil Bortz and the others, and they're Limbo.
You have my compassion.
Yeah, and Limbo, and they say that they are oppressed. The wealthy are paying all the taxes, and they are oppressed by the current tax situation or the way taxes are formulated.
Yeah, 35% is way too much for them.
So my question is this. I have a free subscription to the Wall Street Journal, and I see homes $3, $4, $5, $15, $20, $25, $30 million. Okay, I see wristwatches for $3,000 and $4,000, $5,000.
Okay.
So if the wealthy are paying all this money in taxes, if the wealthy are so oppressed by the current tax system, the obvious question is, who's buying these homes?
Yeah, and it's not. It even goes beyond that, Phil. And that's a very good point. It even goes beyond that because if you look at the cities in the United States, before Reagan came into office in New York City and in Los Angeles, for example, just as two examples, but they're emblematic of cities all across this country. In both those cities, more than 50% of the housing in those two cities was occupied by middle class people, working people who had basically the equivalent of a good union job. Now it's down in the 20% range in both cities. In Manhattan, it's virtually gone. Manhattan, I mean, you know, the Jackie Gleason, the old Honeymooners show, the Lucy show, a lot of these, they showed the middle class of New York City. There is no middle class in Manhattan anymore. It's the very rich and the very poor, or the high end of the extreme high end of middle class and the very poor. And it's not just gentrification, because that's like neighborhoods. We're talking about nuclear bombs being dropped on entire cities economically. Just wiping out the old traditional American middle class, just wiping them out. And it is an absolute disaster. And what has wiped them out is this, frankly, the largest, in my opinion, the number one thing that brought all this about is this change in taxation policy, is dropping the 90 and 70% top marginal tax rates down into the 30% range and jacking up the taxes on working people through your FICA, your unemployment insurance, and through in particular Social Security insurance, which is only paid on the first $90,000 of income. People who make more than $90,000, they don't pay a penny of Social Security beyond that. Coming up in the next hour, Iran, 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back. Our question for this hour, how do we stop? And I want to put this frame out. I think this is a really important and useful frame. How do we stop the permanent war machine? Because that's what it is. How do we stop the permanent war machine from driving us into another war in the Middle East? Article in The Guardian today. Bush is not going to leave office with Iran still in limbo, according to a well-placed source in Washington. Patrick Cronin, director of studies at the International Institute of Strategic Studies, says, quote, Cheney has limited capital left, but if he wanted to use all his capital on this one issue, he could still have an impact. Dick Cheney has long favored upping the threat of military action against Iran. or Iran, I guess is the correct pronunciation. They note also almost half of the U.S.'s 227 warships we have in the world, in the entire planet, we have 227 warships. Almost half of them are stationed close to Iran. This is in this article in The Guardian today by Ewan McCaskill in Washington and Julian Borger in London. Almost half of them. The aircraft carrier USS Enterprise left Virginia last week for the Gulf. A Pentagon spokesman said it was to replace the USS Nimitz and there'd be no overlap, which would mean three carriers in the Gulf at the same time. They had no decision on military action is expected until next year. But at the same time, and this is where it gets very bizarre. Two things here. First of all, the drumbeat to war. Sam Brownback on Fox News.
Iran, yeah. Sean, we've got to go directly at.
Well, do you mean, would you support the idea of taking out their refineries? If they continue to thumb their nose at the world community, threaten Israel, fund Hezbollah and Hamas, would you support the idea of a preemptive strike to stop them before they get nuclear capability?
I think we have to keep the military options on the table. And all of those towards Iran.
But if they seem
because that's one of the key funders and that's one of the key organizing groups around these militant Islamic groups.
So, you know, our issue for the hour, our Bomberan alert is right here, right now.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan. Bom, 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 bom.
Bom, 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 Bomberan.
And that's what they're talking about doing. And what's truly bizarre about this, you go over to Joe Lieberman's website, lieberman.senate.gov, there's this huge press release up there. Senators Lieberman, McCain, Kyle, Graham, and Coleman today introduced a bipartisan amendment to the Defense Authorization Act confronting the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran over its proxy attacks on American soldiers in Iraq. The amendment states that the murder of members of the United States Armed Forces by a former foreign government or its agents is an intolerable act of hostility against the United States and demands the government of Iraq take immediate action and all forms of support.
So are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
And they demand the government of Iran take immediate action in all forms of support it's providing to Iraqi militias and insurgents. And you get, I mean, this is, again, as Senator Kyle said, I mean, this is bizarre. Norm Coleman, gung-ho on this. These guys want a war with Iran. Senator Kyle says, the Iranians are attempting to thwart our policies in the Middle East by actively supporting terrorists who are killing our troops in Iraq. It is time we acknowledge this hostility against us, and this amendment tells the Iranians we will not tolerate any actions which threaten our troops or allies. Senator Norm Coleman, Minnesota, the guy that Al Franken has taken on and out fundraising. God bless Al Franken. Norm Coleman says the United States will not tolerate Iran's hostile attempts to sabotage our efforts in the Middle East region. So let's look at who's really blowing up our soldiers. And the country of Iran, for that matter. This from the Los Angeles Times. Dateline Baghdad by Ned Parker. Reporting for the LA Times. Although Bush administration officials have frequently lashed out at Syria and Iran, accusing it of helping insurgents and militias here, the largest number of foreign fighters and suicide bombers in Iraq come from a third neighbor, Saudi Arabia, according to a senior U.S. military official and Iraqi lawmakers. Here's the breakdown. 45% of all the foreign militants targeting U.S. troops, as well as Iraqi civilians and security forces, are from Saudi Arabia. 45%. 15% are from Syria and Lebanon combined. 10% from North Africa. They don't even have a percentage for Iran. It's so low. Nearly half of the 135 fighters in U.S. detention facilities in Iraq are Saudis. Fighters from Saudi Arabia are thought to have carried out more suicide bombings than those of any other nationality. 50% of all Saudi fighters in Iraq come here as suicide bombers. In the last 6 months, such bombings have killed or injured 4,000 Iraqis. Ned Parker goes on to note in the Los Angeles Times, others contend that Saudi Arabia is allowing fighters sympathetic to Al-Qaeda to go to Iraq so they won't create havoc at home. Iraqi Shiite lawmaker, keep in mind, Saudi Arabia's Sunni, Iraqi Shiite lawmaker Sami Askari, an advisor to Prime Minister Nouri Maliki, accused Saudi officials of a deliberate policy to sow chaos in Baghdad. Said the Iraqi lawmaker, the fact of the matter is that Saudi Arabia has strong intelligence resources, and it would be hard to think that they were not aware of what's going on. In the meantime, while Saudi Arabia is funneling, apparently, or at least, you know, is willfully blind to the funneling of suicide bombers and fighters into Iraq to blow up our troops, our ability to have oversight over our own intelligence has been absolutely crippled by the Bush administration. This in the Washington Post yesterday. Headline, in intelligence world, a mute white watchdog. An independent oversight board created to identify intelligence abuses after the CIA scandals of the 1970s did not send any reports to the Attorney General of legal violations during the first 5.5 years of the Bush administration counterterrorism effort. Now, you say, why would that be? Well, for the first 2 years, there was nobody on the board. The article goes on to say, although the FBI told the board of a few hundred legal or rules violations by its agents after the 9/11 attacks, the board did not identify which of them were indeed legal violations. This is why when Saudi Arabia attacks us, we think it's Iran. You get how just absolutely strange this is? And then on top of that, our Twilight Zone alert here, Rezana Nafik, a 19-year-old housemaid from Sri Lanka, is on death row in Saudi Arabia because the baby in her care died when she was bottle feeding him. This is an Associated Press story. If her appeal is turned down, she will be taken to a public square to be publicly beheaded. Her execution will be the latest in a surge of beheadings in the Saudi kingdom. Amnesty International says some defendants are convicted solely on the basis of confessions obtained under duress, torture, or deception. Kate Allen of Amnesty International called it an absolute scandal that Saudi Arabia is prepared to behead a teenage girl who didn't even have a lawyer at her trial. She's from Sri Lanka. She arrived in Saudi Arabia May 4, 2005 to work as a housemaid, given the additional job of looking after a baby boy who was choking while she was bottle feeding him. The kid choked and died. It happens. It happens rarely, but it happens. She's been sentenced to death for this. Salila Hamad of Saudi Arabia's National Society for Human Rights says, Allah, our creator, knows what's best for and good for his people. Should we just think of and preserve the rights of the murderer and not think of the rights of others? Beheadings are carried out with a sword, with no photos allowed. Prisoners, usually sedated, kneel, flanked by clerics and law enforcement officials, and facing the victim's family. The prisoner now recites verses from the Quran, while a government official reads the charges and the verdict. Halfway through the reading, the executioner suddenly nicks the back of the prisoner's neck with his sword, causing him to tense and raise his head involuntarily. Then, in one swift move, the prisoner is decapitated. Beheadings usually take place in a square next to a mosque. You get how bizarre this is, how absolutely incredibly violent this is? How wrong, you know, if it's Friday, it must be beheading. I mean, that's, seriously, they always take place in Riyadh on Friday. Friday afternoon, it's beheading time. And these are the guys who are sending or from, this is the country from which is coming the vast majority of the people blowing us up. How do we stop the permanent war machine from attacking Iran? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is...
We have to keep working. We have to get out there and get active if we're going to stop this. How do we stop the permanent war machine? Let's just call it what it is. Lieberman, McCain, Kyle, Graham, and Coleman. From this news release over at Lieberman.Senate.gov. How do we stop them from attacking Iran? Meanwhile, by the way, just as we're seeing that over half of the attacks are coming from Saudi Arabia, not Iran, and the number from Iran is functionally unmeasurable. The United Nations nuclear watchdog announced today it has reached agreement with Iranian authorities to allow new inspections and safeguards at home of its key facilities. The deal follows a two-day visit to Iran by a team of IAEA inspectors that ended yesterday. The IAEA and Iran have also agreed to hold another meeting in early August on steps to resolve remaining issues pertinent to the country's past plutonium experiments. And now Iran is asking Japan to pay for their oil in yen. The Japanese would prefer, frankly, to pay in dollars because they have so many extra dollars because our insane trade policies have given them to them. But that's another rant. But how do we stop the permanent war machine? You know, Dwight Eisenhower told us about this. He laid this out for us. And it was so spot on that this was new in our experience.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea.
See, we didn't even have a permanent war machine, an arms industry, during World War II or Korea.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry.
None.
American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well.
And that's what we did. Chrysler, GM, Ford, they all started making tanks.
But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations.
Wow.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience.
And he goes on to point out, not only is it new, but it's potentially dangerous.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
And yet now we find defense contractors who own major television networks who are out there giving lots and lots of FaceTime to the guys who are calling for us to attack Iran, like Joe Lieberman or Senator Kyle or Senator Coleman or Senator Graham, who had a nice dust-up, by the way. Over the weekend. We'll get to that in a little bit. There are Senators Lieberman, McCain, Kyle, Graham, and Coleman today introduced a bipartisan amendment to the Defense Authorization Act, confronting the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran over its proxy attacks on American soldiers. Its proxy attacks? Say what? I saw debate, I guess you'd call it, this confrontation between Jim Webb and Lindsey Graham on Meet the Press over the weekend. And Lindsey Graham tried to make the point that this amendment that Lieberman is talking about in this press release over at Lieberman.Senate.gov, that this amendment, which was somehow mysteriously, I don't get this, how it passed the Senate 97-0, this amendment to the Defense Appropriation Bill, or the Defense Authorization Act is what it's called, was a strong and loud, asserted statement against Iran. And what was so weird was when he said that, when Lindsey Graham said that, Jim Webb brushed it off and said, no, it wasn't. It was like, and I don't have the clip, I'm sorry, but to paraphrase from memory, He said essentially that was just a, you know, a paragraph or after a semicolon, something that was added to the bill. In other words, I don't think the Democrats realized what they were voting on, or at least how it was going to be used. And this is the same kind of thing that was used by the Republicans when they wanted to gin us up to a war in Iraq. They got one of these seemingly inconspicuous, innocuous little things, you know, passed, one of these pieces of legislation that, or a resolution that says, well, we don't think, you know, Iraq represent, or we do think Iraq represents a threat. And that was used to justify attacking Iraq. This is going to be used to justify attacking Iran. Coming up later in the program, by the way, Tara McKelvey on her new book, Monstering, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong, move along like I know you do.
Hey, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com, click on Tom Hartman, and visit the Tom Hartman page. Join our daily blog, put you in the running for a signed copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. David is going to pick his favorite post today, and we will send that person a copy of the book. So check it out, fairamerica.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. And Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Yeah, I assume that when you asked the question what to do about stopping the war machine, you were looking for nonviolent answers.
Yeah.
So I had four. One would be what Joan Baez does, and that is withdraw a certain percentage of your taxes based on the percentage that's spent on war. They end up getting the taxes eventually, but it does slow them down. The other one is to boycott any associated industries that are known, like, say, television stations or TV shows or anything like that, that are sponsored by the known producers of the weapons.
The problem with that one, Steve, I mean, the problem with the first one is obvious, that it makes you feel great and it's a good moral statement, although it can get you in trouble. But by and large, it doesn't make any change. But it is important for us to make statements of a whole variety of forms. I'm not sure that that's the best kind of statement to make. The problem with the second one is if you go over to theyrule.net, there's a brilliant website, theyrule, theyrule.net.
Okay.
You can plug in the names of any two corporations or three corporations or five or ten. I actually did a round robin in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, that goes from, as I recall, IBM to IBM through about 20 companies. And you can plug in a couple of companies. You can see how their boards interlock. There's this small group of a few hundred people in the United States who are on the boards of virtually all of the Fortune 500 companies, the major corporations in America, which includes all the media companies, includes all the defense contractors, and it almost doesn't matter anymore. They're all by each other. And the CEOs of the top 100 companies are all members of the conference board. They get together periodically. Jon Snow was the chairman of that organization. And it's the 100 largest corporations in America, just the CEOs. This is a very exclusive club. And, you know, there's people still running around going, oh, the Masons are secretly running the world, or it's the Rothschilds or whatever. And I'm sorry, it's right out in the open.
The last one I was going to give you is effective, although it's kind of limited scale, and that is I have three sons, two of which are military age, and I've educated them in regards to what the military does in this country, and they're not going to make themselves available as soldiers, so that helps a little bit.
Yeah, well, and I think that a lot of parents are saying that's going to be the case. There are a lot of kids, a lot of people, young people, well, even, you know, whatever age people. I mean, look at military signups, but that's really we're at this point we're dealing with symptoms of the problem. And frankly, I think that the problem will be solved by going back to I've been saying this for 5 years here on this program, going back to the Sherman Act, reinforcing the antitrust laws, breaking up some of these giant combines, and having really serious oversight. I mean, serious and significant and real oversight over the industries that create things that kill people. acknowledging that perhaps we need industries. Well, absolutely, we need industries that create things that kill people. Although it's interesting that, as Eisenhower pointed out, up until the 1950s, we had no permanent arms industry in the United States, military arms industry. None. And it was the domestic arms, you know, the people who made hunting rifles decided to make military weapons. And now we've got a permanent arms industry. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Before I mention something about Southwest Airlines, I just thought I should point out with Iran, one is notice they never really show us the evidence of Iran doing bad things. Secondly, Iran is mostly a really secular society. Most people there are not very religious.
Right.
And, you know, we just...
Although what's interesting, Jeff, is as we, when Bush called them the Axis of Evil, within a few months, you started seeing women wearing the headscarves, and you started, you know, it's the right wingers, the hardline religious conservatives are starting to come out. They're coming out of the closet. They're coming out of the woodwork or whatever, you know. And it's starting to make life miserable for a lot of Iranians.
Oh yeah,
in
but
Iran.
They're the minority.
And, yeah, but they're the minority. But we are empowering them by our behavior.
Yes. Anyway, you've been mentioning for a long time that increased costs are not necessarily passed on to customers.
Right.
And Southwest Airlines finally raised airfares quite minimally, much less than the costs that they've increased costs they've experienced from increased fuel costs. And if you look at the airlines right now, you'll see that the increased costs in fuel have gone to lower profits, gone to restricting growth and all sorts of other things, rather than the same corresponding increased cost to the customer.
Right. And Southwest is a great case in point. It's their CEO makes a rational salary, and it is the most heavily unionized of all the airlines, and yet it is consistently year after year, and has been for several decades, the most profitable.
Yeah, so you're right. Increased costs do not necessarily go to the customer.
Yeah, great. Jeff, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Tim in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jim. Tim.
Morning, Tom. It's funny, I asked this, I wanted to talk about this before you even asked the question, and Lindsey Graham on my Meet the Press yesterday said that we are bringing a form of moderation that is not known in the Middle East. And the reason I thought that was so amazing is that it shows a position and an understanding that is so erroneous that it's dangerous, because Baghdad was the center of learning for hundreds of years until the Mongols invaded, and they had moderation.
Yeah, up until the mid-50s, when we started getting involved, when the CIA started getting involved in both Iraq and Iran, both countries had democratically elected governments.
Exactly, and social justice is the basis of their faith. The idea of national health care is not even an issue. They might not even have a word for it. So what we're trying to do, like you mentioned earlier about the 15% tax rate and abolishing college education, not allowing them to unionize, is a huge, huge insult to
Islam,
their faith. So we yeah. as progressives actually have more in common with Iran than Iran than many people realize. And people like Lindsey Graham and the people that are making the decisions should go a long way into having a conversation with them rather than, you know, to understand their position so that we can have a conversation with them and without screaming and yelling at them.
Yeah, there's a reason why we talked to the Soviet Union when they were pointing nuclear missiles at us. There is a reason why you talk to your enemies unless you're in the middle of a full all-out war with them. I mean, obviously
that's a great point, because the reason we're afraid Iran's going to use nuclear weapons against us is because we would if we were in their position.
People always judge others by themselves. Yeah, good point, Tim. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Tom. First, you wouldn't know which Schuller's bookstore you're going to be at.
I don't. It's the one that's out near the Celebration Cinema. It's the one that's closest to that.
All right. Okay.
But you can find out at WTKG.com. It's our website.
All right. Did you just mention a little while ago that Iran is refusing U.S. dollars?
They're asking the Japanese to pay in yen rather than dollars. And the Japanese are saying, this was as of Wednesday, the Japanese said that they're thinking about it, but they prefer to pay in dollars. And the reason why, obviously, is they have a surplus of dollars from trade with the United States, and the only way that they can get rid of them is to buy oil. That's about the only thing that most of these countries use their dollars for, is to buy oil.
Which is
why, you know, arguably a lot of damage could be done to the United States if a lot of the oil exporting countries stop taking dollars.
Right. I'm wondering if maybe that had precipitated the war drum starting to get beat a little louder.
You know, there was that is one of the more widely held conspiracy theories that I think probably has a lot of truth to it. Saddam Hussein, just before we started bombing him, said that he was going to go to Euros.
Right.
And about a week before we started bombing him, he said, no, I'll go back to dollars. I'll go back to dollars. Don't bomb me.
Yeah.
And, you know, we said, yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, Bush is going to have his war no matter what. But, you know, it's a good point, Julian. I think that it's just another excuse, frankly. It's a way of getting the bankers in on the act and the international traders and everybody. But, yeah, it's a big one. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia, what's up?
I'm going to be brief. We need to challenge these people and call them out. I've been sitting here fuming ever since I heard that, you know, you saying Lieberman was talking about Iran running proxy warriors. The Sunnis are our proxy warriors. Seymour Hersh exposed this. We're using them in Iraq. I know we plan to use them in Iran. So, and we need to point out, Cheney is running a shadow government. He admitted it when he was saying he was not accountable to us.
Sure.
And there is some nut in Israel named Avigdor Lieberman. He said that they were given permission to bomb Iran and we would back them up. We need to tell our politicians, no, we're not. I read an article the other day in The Guardian that there's people that are offering Jews in Iran money to leave. That indicates they want to kill these folks. And if they don't leave, they're going to die too. We need to call them out, point out who the real terrorists are. And it's Bush.
Well, it's a tough one. Bush and company. I'm not going with the Israel's behind it theory. I'm sorry. I think that they perceive there to be a threat there. But this, I may be wrong, but my perception of this is that we're looking at the permanent war machine here. We're looking at the beast, at the Halliburton and Cheney beast more than anything else. And you know, time will tell, of course. But my strong sense is that this is the permanent war machine. Coming up in the next hour, Inside America's policy of secret interrogations and torture in the terror war. And back to your calls right after this break. 45 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
It's Friday night. Now, what do we do next? I just can't seem to figure it out.
Bomb, 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 bomberan.
Bomb, 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 bomberan.
Let's bomberan.
This off the website of Joe Lieberman, Lieberman.Senate.gov. Big news! Senators Lieberman, well, it's from last week, but it's still being flogged over the weekend. Lindsey Graham on Meet the Press saying, this is a big deal! Jim Webb saying, what? Senator Lieberman, McCain, Kyle, Graham, and Coleman today introduced a bipartisan amendment to the Defense Authorization Act confronting the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran over its proxy attacks on American soldiers in Iraq. Yet, 50% of the people arrested in Iraq from outside the country are from Saudi Arabia. Iran's so low on the percentage that it doesn't even show up. Ellen Ratner on the line with us from Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, how are you? The president today met with the Polish president, and they were talking all about the security shield. The president of Poland said that the Russians should not worry, that it doesn't really threaten them, and that this is really a defense instrument for them. I got news for you. If that's not putting lipstick on a pig, I don't know what is.
And Putin's not buying it. I mean, last week he said, that's it. We're not going to continue participating in the nuclear non-proliferation treaty.
Right. So he just stopped there. So that, of course, that's another hot button. Now, I don't usually quote from the U.S. News and World Report, but they've done, this actually isn't in their magazine, but they have actually done a very interesting thing, and they have tracked all the people leaving the Justice Department. And it looks as if part of who is leaving the Justice Department in the last few months, they have had the heads of the Office of Legal Policy, the Tax Division, the Office of Legislative Affairs, and one other person, the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division, is apparently ready to jump ship as well. And I actually know somebody who is there who just said that not only does he dislike the Attorney General, but he is a crummy administrator.
The Attorney General is.
So I think the Justice Department is going to be decimated, and where is the president going to get the approval for some of these positions? Deputy positions don't need to be approved, but, you know, in Congress and in oversight. Of course, the Congress, as we learned from the president the other day, their mainly responsibility is to fund the troops.
Right. Just give us the money, guys, and shut up. That's the official Bush line. And first he destroyed FEMA. Now he's destroying the Justice Department. I mean, this is an ancient institution. I have a question for you, Ellen. On Meet the Press over the weekend, Senator Lindsey Graham went off on this thing about Iran. In fact, here's just a little
piece of
it.
Before we go, what happens in September?
I think General Petraeus will determine what happens in September, but in July, we're not going to let politicians deploy troops based on the polling of the moment. And I think the biggest mistake we could make is misunderstand our enemies. Iran is killing Americans and trying to destabilize this government.
There you go. Iran is killing America. I mean, these guys are putting this meme out aggressively, yet it doesn't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. Joe Lieberman and along with Norm Coleman and Kyle and Graham and McCain put forward this resolution that was attached to the Defense Authorization Act. But when here's what boggles my mind, or what I'm curious about. When Lindsey Graham pointed out that this resolution was attached to the Defense Authorization Act, Jim Webb, who voted for it, said words to the effect of, oh, that was just a paragraph. Like, that was just a bit of legal language or something. Like, it was no big deal. This is a big deal, isn't it?
Well, it's a very big deal, and what's also very interesting is, you know, they're going after Iran, and I don't know if you saw the article in the LA Times yesterday, but essentially the article said that that a lot of the responsibility in Iraq, sorry, I'm now on the street in front of the United Nations,
that's okay.
That a lot of what was going on in terms of that was that these were Sunni fighters, and they were being put forth, not directly, but certainly indirectly, from Saudi Arabia. So why aren't we talking about going after Saudi Arabia?
Exactly. And I shared that article with my listeners a little bit ago. But what I'm curious about is, how did this Lieberman resolution get a 97-0 vote in the Senate?
I have no idea. But
I am absolutely convinced that the Democrats had no idea what they were voting on.
Well, they may not have any idea what they're voting on, but I will also say that the Democrats are terrified that Lieberman is going to leave the party, and then they are really, really up a creek in terms of control of the Senate. And so I know a lot of the Democrats are doing things to please Lieberman in whatever way they can.
I would love to know if the Constitution of the state of Connecticut allows for what is it that happened in California, you know, where you call back a governor, you call back a senator and just say, sorry, you're not our senator anymore, as opposed to impeachment, or if it were require some sort of impeachment of Lieberman. I mean, I don't think that he is representing the people of Connecticut the way they want to be represented, although I may be wrong.
Well,
I mean, what's your sense of it?
That clearly may be. The point is, though, that Democrats are bowing down to Lieberman because he has them by the huevos,
so
to speak. Yeah.
But a recall petition for Lieberman would be, I think, a really useful thing for the citizens of Connecticut.
But you've got enough listeners in Connecticut. I think you could start it.
Yeah, well, hopefully some good citizen, I mean, it would have to be initiated by a citizen of Connecticut. Hopefully somebody will start it. About a half a minute, Ellen, what else is going on in the world?
Okay, well, the other interesting thing, of course, is the defense bill, which you just sort of briefly mentioned with Lieberman, et cetera. That is coming up, and, of course, the Lugar Amendment is what the White House is now saying And they're saying that they're going to veto that as well. And this is done by the Republicans in the Senate as sort of a compromise, and Bush isn't even willing to compromise with Senator Lugar and the other Republicans.
Yeah, my take on Lugar and John Warner's authorization saying, or their bill saying that the president has to present a new authorization for the war, is that ultimately that's probably going to be the one that's going to be successful. It'll probably be early next year. And this will be the way that the Republicans will take credit for ending the war, and they'll campaign against Bush in the upcoming elections.
Right in time for the 2008 special.
There you go. Yeah, that's my take on it. Alan Ratter of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Inside America's policy of secret interrogations and torture in the terror war. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. How is, well, you know, rhetorically, I guess, in the first hour of our program, we were examining how conservative and Republican policies for 26 years have been destroying the middle class of America, economic opportunity in this country, and destroying families in the United States. In the second hour, we looked at how they're destroying families in Iraq, and how there's a concerted effort to gin up a policy, a consensus for a policy of attacking Iran. And now comes along Tara McKelvey with a great new book, Monstering, Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. She's the senior editor at the American Prospect and a research fellow at NYU's Law School Center on Law and Security. Tara, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks very much for inviting me.
Great to have you with us. Prospect.org, by the way, is the website for what you're doing. And some of the stuff in this book is mind-boggling. Your interview with Lindy England, for example.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. It was not an easy interview to do.
I can imagine. Tell us about the essence of it.
Well, I met with her in the brig. I was actually the only journalist who was able to get in there and talk to her. And we were in a visiting room, and I spent a couple days with her. And I asked her about some of the things that she had seen and heard and been involved in when she was at Abu Ghraib.
And she said?
Well, I did ask her, for instance, whether she felt remorse for what had happened. I mean, obviously, she's the woman who's pictured in the photographs. She's known as the lady with the leash because she has a prisoner on a leash in one of the pictures. And she did tell me that she felt differently about the things that had taken place there, but she wasn't quite able to say that she felt remorse for what had happened. It was more, from what I got from her, it was more a sense of remorse that she was behind bars.
That she got caught.
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
it was a hard interview.
What kind of rationalization would lead somebody, or what kind of a worldview would lead somebody to think that what she did was okay? And by the way, let me point out, also your book talks about how the Bush administration basically created that worldview and echoed it all the way down to people like Lindy England.
That's right. I mean, the defense that was used in her court-martial was that she had what was known as a compliant personality, and that made her especially vulnerable to orders that came from up high, for instance, and these orders were to do things to the detainees that would lower their defenses so that they would be more susceptible during the interrogations. And she was also under the sway of a powerful and charismatic and violent boyfriend by the name of Charles Grainer.
So, but she, you know, that description is, you know, it evokes a little bit of empathy, I suppose. But it's not a description that you can apply to every single person who was participating in this.
Not
and there
at all.
Were many.
Not at all. And even in the case of Lindy England, I didn't find her to have a compliant personality. She's very smart. She can be very engaging. When I met her, she was learning electrical engineering. She was planning for her future. She was really looking forward to a new life that she wanted to start. And, in fact, she showed lots of examples throughout her life of times that she was tough and stood up to people who were in positions of authority and did not go along with orders or things that she were told that she was told to do.
So what's the worldview that allows this kind of thing to happen? Is it that, you know, we take orders from the top? Is it that it's a dangerous world? And how does she come to, and for that matter, how does Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush come to objectifying other human beings as essentially objects, as evil? I mean, how does that happen?
I think that's the million-dollar question. It's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about, and the people come to it in different ways. There are certain individuals in the lead-up to the Abu Ghraib scandal who seem to believe that they were doing things that were for the good of the nation. For instance, John Yoo, who is in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. He's, of course, a Harvard and Yale-trained lawyer, and he's now on the faculty at Berkeley. And he is the person who's behind many of the memos that redefined torture and allowed for these abusive actions to take place. He believes certainly in expanding the powers of the presidency during wartime. And he had shown a long history of that, and this was consistent with his worldview.
In fact, he debated Bob Barr at the Conservative Political Action Conference that I went to. I did my show from there. And I think I was the only guy in the entire room, 3,000 people, that wasn't a conservative. And Bob Barr, who is an old-fashioned conservative, was saying, this is wrong. We shouldn't give this much power to the executive. And John Yoo was saying, oh, no. We need to basically make him king because we're at war. And yet Bush is saying this is a war that's going to go on forever, for the rest of our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes.
That's right. And for conservatives, like you saw, a lot of them are opposed to it because it's not always going to be somebody they want who's in office. So they have to contend with that in the future. And one of the other people who was involved in this discussion was a man named Timothy Flanagan, a lawyer who was under Gonzalez. And Timothy Flanagan told me that he believed that using these harsh techniques on high-level al-Qaeda suspects would help prevent a future terrorist attack, that it was one of the tools that we needed to use in the war on terror. And so he believes that in some sense he was on the side of the angels. He wanted to protect us. So some of these decisions were made with the best of intentions.
We're talking with Tara McKelvey, the senior editor at the American Prospect and author of a new book, Monstering, Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. And, Tara, this is what you deal with throughout the book. I mean, from robo-tripping, these soldiers doing Robitussin and Vivarin and pretending to stab detainees, the formerly unreleased material about an American accused of raping an Iraqi child, some of the techniques that Americans used against Iraqis who had never actually even been charged with a crime, all of this stuff. And it reminds me, in a way, of some years ago I was in London and I went to the torture museum. Well, in fact, you see this in a lot of castles, you know, around the UK and some of the other European countries, where they still have intact the old dungeons and they have the instruments of torture. And we don't so much ask, what did the torturer think? Instead, we're saying, you know, what did the king think? Or why did the queen allow this? That kind of thing. And that's really the big question here, is this thing was all driven from the top down. What are the things that our soldiers were doing that should horrify all of us, and that, frankly, I suspect for many of them, horrify them after the fact, even if it didn't Lindy England? And how do we stop this from happening again in the United States of America?
Well, the first part of the question that it was all driven by people who were very high in the government, that may be true. Certainly, I spent a lot of time trying to track where these orders came from. But it's also true that the people at the very lowest ranks were participating. Everybody at every point in time had a choice. I interviewed one soldier named Hydro Joyner who worked for the day shift at Abu Ghraib in Tier 1A, where most of those photographs were taken in the fall of 2003. And he told me that he got orders from up high to implement what was known as a sleep plan, which basically meant keep the prisoners awake until they went almost crazy. And he said, well, look, I'm not going to be just doing this. You have to put this in writing. And they did that. So then he implemented the plan and went through it for a period of time and watched the prisoners just get tormented. And at a certain point in time, he stopped the sleep plan. He just turned the music off, stopped harassing the prisoners. Nothing happened to him. There were no repercussions. So the point is that he was able to just say, I'm not going to participate, but others did not say that.
Right. And the Cy Hirsch talked about this, about the rape used as a technique of of intimidation and torture?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That particular aspect of the abuse was very hard to track. It's hard to know how systematic that was. Certainly, women talked to me who were held at the prison. They described different ways that other women were physically abused, sexually abused. It was very difficult for them to talk about their own experiences. I mean, even though it seemed pretty clear through their body language or some of the things they said more obliquely that they had been through something similar, but because of the stigma that was attached to sexual assault, they were never able to say explicitly what had happened to them.
Right. And you have in your book firsthand accounts of Americans using high voltage devices, sexual intimidation, and pharmaceutical drugs on Iraqis who were what?
There's a report from the International Committee of the Red Cross in October 2003 that found that anywhere between 70 and 90% of the detainees at Abu Ghraib had no information that would be useful to American troops. They were either caught up in sweeps, they were innocent, or they were guilty of petty crimes that had nothing to do with the attacks on the troops. And it wasn't just the Red Cross that said that. There were several individuals with military intelligence units who testified.
This is a truly horrifying book, but it's something that we do need to confront in this country. Tara McKelvey, Monstering the Book, Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War, Prospect.org. Tara, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes. Well, it's troubling talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Today you're working for the man.
We're all working for the man here. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Terry O'Sullivan on the line, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America. Liuna, LIUNA.org, the website. Hey, Terry.
How you doing, Tom?
I am great. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm in sunny San Francisco today.
Oh, it's a beautiful town. Tell me about Connie Craig.
Connie Craig, and talk about working for the man.
Yeah.
Connie Craig's story is a story of some of the pressing issues facing this country and what happens when working people try to improve their lives. Connie is one of those people who make America work. She's 38 years old, married, has two kids. She's working for a company right there in Portland, your town of Portland, called Marquez Brothers. It's a $130 million company that is one of the biggest specialty food distributors in the United States. She earns $8 an hour, which is about $16,000 a year. She has no sick leave. Health care is out of reach and is a pipe dream. She doesn't complain about her job. She doesn't, like every other working American, she's fighting to make things better by joining together with her coworkers. Our laborers, Local 483 there in Portland, signed up 80% of Marquez Brothers' workforce, and they responded by harassing workers and firing workers because they don't want them to join together to form a union.
If 80% of the members of the employees of a company join a union, isn't there some legal requirement that the company recognize the union?
Well, you can go to go file a petition for an election, Tom. The problem is that's when many employers, this particular employer, threaten, coerce, and intimidate the employees. I mean, get these facts. And this was the importance of trying to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which we didn't pass.
Which the Republicans filibustered in the Senate. It would have passed. There was a majority willing to vote for it, actually. But the Republicans filibustered this thing in the Senate.
Exactly right. Passed the House, had 51 votes in the Senate, but they filibustered. And Bush the president wasn't going to sign it if it ever passed anyway. But listen to these, Tom. I think your listeners will find this interesting. In elections, NLRB elections, 30% of employers fire pro-union workers. 49% of employers threaten to close a work site when workers try to form a union. 51% of employers coerce workers into opposing unions with bribery or favoritism. 82% of employers hire high-priced union-busting consultants to fight union organizing campaigns. And 91% of employers force employees to attend one-on-one anti-union meetings with their supervisors. And you talk about fair, you talk about working for the man. These are hardworking Americans that are just trying to make life better for themselves and their families. And when we have laws in this country, labor laws, that don't facilitate people being able to join together to form a union and collectively bargain with their employer.
We're talking with Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org is their website. And Terry, if we can't even get card check passed, I suppose it's a big deal. You know, in some ways it's chopping back parts of Taft-Hartley. But if we can't even get that passed, and we've got the Bush administration here appointing people to the National Labor Relations Board who are openly hostile to labor, we've had, with the singular exception of the 8 years of the Clinton administration, ever since Reagan came into office, we've had people hostile to labor running the Department of Labor. How do we change this? Or is the only way to change it to change the presidency?
I think we have to do a couple of things, Tom, and you've been talking about it. I mean, as progressives and working people, we need to reunite, and we need to come together in 08. We need to do the following. We need to pick up seats in the House of Representatives so that we have veto-proof power. We need to pick up seats in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, and we need to put a Democrat in the White House that will sign progressive legislation. As you said, now the Democrats control Congress, but by thin margins. And if you don't have 60 votes, you can't get something passed in the Senate to invoke cloture. So to me, to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, comprehensive immigration reform, and progressive legislation, it's going to take working people increasing our ranks in the Democratic Party and increasing our numbers in the House and the Senate, and have a Democratic president that sees life through the eyes of working people in this country.
Yeah, and it's not enough to just vote.
No, we have to get back to our activist and progressive roots as working people, as organized labor. And we need to make sure that politicians understand that the most valuable asset that we have in this country, with all due respect, it's not corporate America, it's not Wall Street, it's working people.
Yeah. And in fact, I, the first hour I was going off on this rant about how this thing in the New York Times about Mr. Weil, the former chairman of Citicorp, is a billionaire now, and he's saying he made all that money. I'm like, no, I'm sorry, your employees made all that money. It's just, you got it. They didn't. Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org. Terry, thanks for being with us today.
It's always great being with you, Tom. Look forward to it next week.
I do too. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
No shame in a job well done. Driving a nail, driving a crook. As a matter of fact, I'd like to set things straight. A few more people should be pulling their weight. If you want a crown course in reality, you get yourself a working man's PhD.
Yeah, it's called a union. A working man's PhD. By the way, drop by the AirAmerica.com blog. You go to AirAmerica.com, click on my name. It'll take you to the Tom Hartman page and join the blog. It actually is called Louise Hartman's Blog. And you'll be in the running another 10 minutes or so here before David decides what he thinks is the his favorite, the coolest or whatever. I don't know, whatever you call it. The David's favorite post for the day, and that person will receive a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. We got a couple of crazy alerts for you today. They're good ones, too. Number one here, a pilot forgets to lower his wheels when landing. This is Middleborough, Kentucky. Lined up with the runway, check. Engine speed, check. Landing gear, oops. Pilot ran through the usual steps of getting ready to land his small plane, except for one little thing, forgot to drop his gear. Fortunately, he just skidded down the runway. more often than not, when that happens, planes like burst into flames and things. In fact, I got to tell you, I am a private pilot. It's been 2 decades since I flew, so I'm not a safe private pilot, but I'm a licensed private pilot. And we used to fly a lot back in the 70s. And Louise and I, in fact, one time flew out to L.A. in the small plane. We lived in Lansing, Michigan, and had a rented small plane from a local IFB and or AFB or whatever, local guy. And it was a local club, actually. And it was a Cherokee. It had a retractable gear, an Apache. And as we were flying into Carefree, Arizona. We had some friends who were living in Carefree. And this was back in the 70s when Carefree was like this little town out in the middle of nowhere. It was just even dark out in the desert. And I'd been flying all day long. I was totally wiped out. We had been flying from someplace east of Texas. I forget where it was. And the sun was just going down. And we were flying into this airport that had no control tower and, you know, was just surrounded by a barbed wire fence or a chain link fence. And you go through this GUMPS, right? Gear, undercarriage, anyhow, this whole list, this checklist. And I thought I'd gone through the checklist. And I'm coming down to land, and I'm maybe, I don't know, 500 yards out from the runway, coming down to land. And all of a sudden, a cow walks out in the middle of the runway. And Louise is sitting next to me, and our daughter at the time was at the time 3 years old. She was in the back. And Louise says, "Whoa, there's a cow on the runway!" And so I reach down to pull up the gear as I'm going to pull the plane up to leave the runway. And as I reached down to pull up the gear, I realized when I put my hand on it that I never dropped the gear. And had I hit that runway, even if there wasn't a cow there, we probably all would have been dead. So I, you know, push the throttle forward, go up, fly around, come back down, come back around. This time drop the gear. We land the plane and take it over to the tarmac on the side and park it. And we're looking around and there's no cow. And we spent 15 minutes walking around that place while we were waiting for our friends to come pick us up. The airport was surrounded by a chain link fence. The gate was closed, and there was no cow. I'm still trying to figure that one out. Anyhow, our second crazy alert, this one for particularly all the folks in Michigan, were on several radio stations in Michigan. 49-year-old Michigan man says he only sought excitement in his life when he ran nude through his community. What he got is 30 days in jail for wearing only stocking cap, gloves, and reflective tape. Police said that Russell Road of Jackson County's Blackman Township has been running naked since he was a teenager. His wife never knew about it. He generally got up early each day so that she wouldn't find out. He was arrested on the 4th of April after a caller reported seeing a naked man running in the southbound lane of US 127. So, strange stuff going on. Anyhow, Robert in Daly City, California. Let's get to some more serious issues here. Robert, hey, welcome.
Hi, Tom. If you want to prevent or end a war in Iran, all you have to do is investigate 9/11. 500 firefighters and first responders were refused testimony at the Keene Commission. 20 were allowed with the janitor. That was the only testimony held behind closed doors, and it was sealed for reasons of national security. Go to YouTube or 9/11 Mysteries. Because of the technological advances we've had, we have live recordings of the bombs going off in buildings. We have all this stuff. The PNAC people wanted it to happen. We just have to come to a place where we demand a complete investigation of 9/11, because 9/11 is the pretext for everything that follows. I mean, U.S. Air Force
I got it. 9/11 is the Pearl Harbor that PNAC. Whoops. 9/11 is the Pearl Harbor that PNAC said we've got to have a Pearl Harbor if we're going to have our invasion of Iraq and everything else. Spot on. And it does need to be investigated. Absolutely. And 9/11truth.org and a lot of other great websites out there looking into it. And we're going to continue talking about that on this program for a good long time. Constance in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Constance.
Tom, I saw you when you were out here in June.
Well,
and or May, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I have there's something that's been working on my mind for the last couple weeks. You know, New Mexico had David Iglesias, who was removed of his duties, and I started becoming very curious about who had replaced him.
Mm-hmm.
So I called down to the U.S. Attorney's Office down in Albuquerque, and they said nobody had replaced him. And the thing is that New Mexico is very vulnerable. We're a prime target for caging. And I think that this administration is up to something by holding off maybe until the 11th hour to get somebody in there that's really bad.
Well, the problem is now that anybody they try and put in there, is going to be subject to Senate confirmation. They snuck one guy in. I forget where it was now. And, you know, before Bush signed the law saying that they're undoing that thing that got slipped in by Arlen Specter's aide, the guy who then went on to become the U.S. attorney from Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
That got slipped into the Patriot Act and or the renewal of the Patriot Act. And so now they have to have Senate confirmation. So my guess is, I agree with you, Constance, my guess is that the political calculus that they're doing is that it's better to have nobody than somebody that they can't absolutely control. And somebody that they can absolutely control is not going to make it past the Senate.
There's
probably a bunch of these spots that are going to remain open. Thanks for pointing that out. I didn't realize that there was nobody had been appointed. Thank you very much. Stephanie in Woodbury, Vermont. Hey, Stephanie.
Hey. Wow, that was a long time waiting. So you said something earlier on your show today that, I think it was the show that I listen on WDEV in Vermont, they were showing, you were is it true that on today's show you were talking with the woman who was in front of the U.N.? Giving the report in front of the U.N.?
Oh, yeah, Ellen Ratner. She actually was just, she walked out in front of the U.N. With her cell phone while she was giving us her, you know, news of the day, but yeah.
So Russia didn't pull out of the NPT. Russia pulled out of the CFE, the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty.
Ah, okay, thank you.
So just a correction
Thank you for
there.
Correcting me. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Sure, excellent show. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. It's I've got the smartest listeners in the world. I'll tell you, this is just the Richard in Cotati, California. Is that it?
Yeah, Cotati. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Richard.
It's great
What's
to
up?
Be on the show with you.
Thank
Listen,
you for calling.
Listen, I just want to offer up some thoughts, and please pardon them if they sound like generalizations. But earlier, when you were talking about war, you know, I really admire your passion for history, and you know, something history, of course, is continually reveals that it's condemned to repeat itself. But you know, I really think as the way things go, it's very much about power and control and greed, and I have so many friends that talk about conspiracies, but you know. When you quote Eisenhower, it's really important for people to understand that I think things have evolved here so much so since he began to, you know, provide those prophetic details about what could potentially happen about war profiteering here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, this is not about a conspiracy. This is about the way business continues to be done since.
Well, yeah, that's the point that I made, Richard, is that, people are going around going, oh, it's, the Masons are all behind it, or the Rothschild family, or the International Bank. Well, there's probably a few folks who are making some money here and there. But really, this is all being done right out in the open. If you go to theyrule.net, you can just go, look at, who the people are. I mean, for example, but by and large, it is, I guess you could call it a conspiracy. It's a bunch of people getting together to do something, but it ain't a secret what's happening to the United States and the world. I mean, NAFTA wasn't a secret. The World Trade Organization is not a secret. The fact that they can sue, that corporations can now sue sovereign governments is not a secret. It's publicized. It's right out there. Gary in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. A little constructive thought here, and maybe it's a little, I don't know if it's a little constructive criticism. But how come us progressive, liberal, moderate Democrats, if you will, independents, why don't we publicly challenge Limbaugh and Hannity to a public televised debate, or for that matter, radio debate?
They won't take
Somehow
it. They won't even take you. If you try to call into their shows, they won't put you on the air.
I know, but that's not my question. We know that he's cowardly. I know this in my heart. He's very smart, but he won't get out from his. It seems to me, Tom, we will not gain any real traction when we need it. We really need it now, unless we flush these two people out, or unless we flush them out.
Yeah. I mean, I encourage. There's a callingallwingnuts.org, I think, is the website. There's Mike Stark, there's a guy out there who is getting people to call into right wing talk shows and give them a hard time. And speak the truth to them. And in fact, I think he's the guy who got on O'Reilly's show and said Keith Olbermann, and that's when O'Reilly went ballistic and said, "We're going to have security come after you, buddy," and go through this whole. It was really tragic when you think about it. But I don't think that it's those guys on the radio who are the problem. It's the whole worldview. I mean, there's an entire industry. I mean, all these think tanks and everything else that is devoted to promulgating a worldview and a philosophy which has been tried now for 27 years and has failed. And what we need to be doing is highlighting the reality of that and the failures of it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
What we got, if the president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
27 years of insane conservative economic policies, and this is what it's brought us. It really and truly has. By the way, congratulations to B.J. Obotz. B.J. Obotts, the blogger over at airamerica.com/TomHartmanPage, and who posted a blog, David's favorite blog, just like Hitler before he invaded Poland. People always claim if only they had known what Hitler would do, they would have stopped him before he was able to commit all the atrocities he committed. Well, here is Bush preparing to murder thousands of Iranians with a controlled nuclear air attack, and who will stop him? And I'll let you read the rest of the blog. You can go over and check it out at airamerica.com. Click on my name, and it'll take you over there. And congratulations. Speaking of congratulations, by the way, Harry Reid is really doing something right. It is time to call Senator Reid's office and say thank you. Just a very quick call, 202-225-3121, and just say, God bless you, Harry Reid. Harry Reid just announced that in response to conservative obstructionism, this is from the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, in response to conservative obstructionism, Harry Reid plans to force war supporters to physically remain in the Senate tonight and filibuster Iraq withdrawal legislation. Reid accused conservatives of, quote, protecting the president rather than protecting our troops by denying us an up or down vote on the most important issue our country faces. He's talking about the vote on the Reid-Levin Iraq legislation. He says if it's not allowed today or tomorrow, he will keep the Senate in session straight through the night on Tuesday. Excuse me, I said tonight, it's tomorrow night. Straight through the night on Tuesday and force a filibuster. This is from Reid's, the actual words Reid said. I would like to inform the Republican leadership and all my colleagues that we have no intention of backing down. If Republicans do not allow a vote on Levin Reid today or tomorrow, we will work straight through the night on Tuesday. The American people deserve an honest and open debate on this war, and they deserve an up or down vote on this amendment to end it. God bless you, Harry Reid. Speaking of senators, Joe in Brookings, Oregon, you want to let me know about what can or can't be done about Joe Lieberman, I'm assuming.
Yes, you cannot recall a United States senator. If you could, probably a lot of these bums would be recalled a lot of the time.
As I recall, the Supreme Court, in fact, dealt with this in the 90s, didn't they? Now that I think back on it.
I don't know. But remember Bob Packwood? You know, the sex stuff came up about him right after the 92 election. We were basically stuck with him until Pack would resign.
But the
fact of the matter is, people need to be calling Harry Reid and Dick Durbin telling them, hey, quit capitulating down to Joe Lieberman. If he leaves, if he leaves, so what?
Yeah.
Let him go.
Yeah.
We don't need.
Yeah, life goes on. You can, if you want to bottle up the Senate, you can do it with 40 votes if you've got the will and the political savvy and whatnot. Yeah, exactly. Joe, thanks a lot. And yeah, in fact, I just got a note here from Michael. I don't know if he wants his last name out. He says, like you, I'd like to see Senator Lieberman recalled. Unfortunately, that's not legally possible. U.S. Senator is a federal office, therefore the states cannot set requirements for holding that office. The U.S. Constitution, which sets a 6-year term for senators, prevails. For example, the California Constitution allows recalls. This made Governor Gray Davis subject to recall. However, Senators Boxer and Feinstein cannot be recalled. The Supreme Court visited this issue in the 1990s when several states tried to apply term limit laws to members of Congress. It ruled that only an amendment to the federal Constitution could set term limits for federal office. Similarly, only an amendment to the U.S. Constitution would establish recalls for senators and representatives. Well, and then if he's going to be impeached, then I guess he would have to be impeached by the House of Representatives. and convicted in the Senate as a federal officer, and that ain't going to happen either. So I don't know what the people of Connecticut can do right now other than, I suppose, lobby Joe Lieberman. Hey, you know, Joe, get with it here. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian.
Okay, Tom. Now that I hear that, I guess there's virtually nothing that we can do in Connecticut, but what we could do, or what they could do, stand out in front of his office every day.
Yeah.
Stand there
every and get a lot of people involved.
A lot of people.
Okay, he's got another 5 years, but still, get a lot. Yeah, I mean, these guys are not immune to pressure.
Force them to resign. Just tell them to get out of there. Same thing with Graham. Same with any of these other people who are in there. Because if they stay in there, or when they do vote next time, because I'm more than likely, Lieberman didn't win anyway. He probably cheated.
Well, I think actually what happened was the Republicans did not support their own candidate. So the Republican candidate only got 3% of the vote. And you had, 30-40% of the voters were Republicans. They voted for Lieberman, plus arguably a minority, perhaps a slim majority of Democrats voted for Lieberman. But I think that it was a minority of Democrats probably voted for Lieberman, and the majority of them voted for Ned Lamont. But you ended up with Lieberman because the Republicans all threw in behind him. And that's, by the way, not lost on Lieberman, which is a concern. So Tony in Arcata, California. Hey, Tony, quick one. We're just about out of time here.
Oh, yeah. First of all, I really appreciate you putting things in a historical perspective. And my main point was that the Bush administration's response to what's happening in Iraq, which I hesitate to call a war or an occupation, is so bizarre that all I can figure out is things must be going swimmingly well for those guys. I mean, Exxon has record profits. They just got control of the oil. So
Cheney paid more in taxes last year than his salary should have been as vice president. He's still getting income from Enron or from Halliburton. Really. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. Tony, thanks. Good point, well made. And in fact, speaking of historical context, I also want to share with you the story of Abe Lincoln. We'll have to do that tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the Competitive Enterprise Institute says we're paying $1 trillion a year for federal regulations. Let's just get rid of them. We're going to be debating that with Wayne Cruz. Jim Dean is here, Howard's brother from democracyforamerica.com. And as always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. It all begins with you. It really and truly does. That's how this country works. That's how it's always worked. So get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.